The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners. This is the Horror Hill podcast, and I'm your host, Eric Peabody. We're going to keep the intro a bit brief this evening, because man oh man, do I have a doozy in store for you. Ancient aliens, shady government organizations, and the most powerful being in all of the universe. Tonight's story is so vast that we can't possibly cover it all in one episode. So, this is part one of J.G. Martin's His Crooked Gospel. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our Dark Circle, listeners. And now, from author J.G. Martin, I give you His Crooked Gospel, Part 1. October 12, 1991. The forest is nothing but a black smear. I can hardly see my handlebars, but that's fine because I've biked these woods my entire life, all 12 years of it. I could ride this trail with my eyes closed if I had to. And I pretty much do. My bicycle bucks and jolts, shuddering as we rattle across the wooden bridge, and I shudder along with it. If I'm being honest, I feel a little uncomfortable, maybe even frightened. There's something in the air tonight, a chill. It's the sort that crawls up your spine, that carries with it the deep-rooted knowledge that something about your surroundings is deeply wrong. It's that unsettling sensation of being watched, pursued. I stand up and ride harder. My lungs burn with every push of the pedals, but I can't shake the feeling that I need to get out of these woods and fast. Visions of serial killers claw at my mind, but I bury them with gritted teeth, as if I need more fuel for my stress. After all, I'm racing towards an altogether different horror. Watching my sister die in slow motion. She's not doing well. Are your mother and father home? No, ma'am. Can you get here to be with her? I'm afraid she doesn't have long. Yes, ma'am, no matter what. Hope. My big sister, Hope, is dying in a hospital room while I'm out here jumping at shadows. Tears sting my eyes, shame burning hotter than my screaming muscles. She deserves better than a coward for a brother. Hope deserves someone who... Thunder. It cracks the sky, rumbling like the bass of infinity. A gale slams into me from behind. It's a battering ram of wind, ravishing the forest like a tempest. Branches snap like bones, ricocheting through the air as shrapnel. One slashes my cheek. Another nearly blinds me. I cry out, one hand flying up in defense, the other desperately trying to steer. This is madness. It's like a tornado crept up on me in the dead of night. It's like... My eardrums bleed. The thunderclap grows louder, more deafening. It's as though the whole forest is shaking now, like the ground might split in two and swallow me whole. My bike protests beneath me, metal groaning as I fight to keep us upright. A flash of white, then another. I wonder if it's lightning, if the storm's right on top of me, but then my world blinks away, turns into nothing but a ringing void. I'm hollering, shouting. I can't see a thing. And then I feel my seat jerk out from under me as I lose control of my bike. My spine twists as my body careens through the air. I brace myself for a broken arm, a sprained ankle. I brace myself for the crunch of gravel meeting my face. But it never arrives. Nothing does. For a while, it's like I'm just floating there, like gravity is unable to finish what it started. I wonder if I've died and this is limbo or purgatory, or the worst heaven anybody's ever imagined. But then my world reappears. It happens slow. It starts as a blurry smudge, but soon graduates into a shifting mess of pine trees.
Help!
The word tears from my throat.
Somebody help!
It's useless. Nobody can hear me. I know that because I'm too far away. I'm watching in horror as the forest fades from view, watching as the trees turn into matchsticks below. My heart is racing like a Formula One engine, and I keep telling myself this isn't real because it can't be. I'm floating. Up and up, high into the coal black sky, stolen by a beam of light. Present day. That was a long time ago, 30 years, give or take. A lot's changed since then, but the nightmares remained the same. I have it almost every night. I dream about that flashbang glow, that cosmic roar, and the gut-churning dread of being eaten by the sky. I dream about things that don't exist. Of course, they have no right to. My name is Isaiah Mitchell, and I'm a boogeyman. Only I don't hide in closets or haunt old houses. I'm the type that boomers rant about while watching the evening news, the type that tinfoil hats point to when things go wrong. I'm what you might call a man in black, and that means I'm well-connected. I know things. I'm privy to information that the president couldn't eavesdrop on if he tried. And so when I tell you that something big happened last night, I'm not talking about the stock market dipping a couple percentage points or the Saudis slashing oil prices. I'm talking about a disaster. A reality-warping clusterfuck that's got me questioning my own sanity. One that'll have you questioning yours, too. Don't believe me? Let's put it to the test. I'm going to tell you a story. It's about me, but it's also about you. Really, it's about everything in the universe, right down to the last atom. It takes place across sprawling starscapes over endless eons. It's about an alien race, a renegade heretic, and a fallen god unable to outrun its own miserable humanity. It's the story of the greatest man to ever live, and how his search for meaning may soon cost us everything. It goes like this. 12 October, 1991.
Hello?
My voice echoes in the void as I scramble to my feet, rubbing my eyes. The shadows are thick enough to taste. It's the forest all over again, only worse. I stumble forward, arms outstretched, desperate for any hint of my surroundings. My palms connect with the surface. Cold, smooth. It almost feels like metal, but it's too soft, too malleable. Footsteps. I shrink backwards, instinctively seeking somewhere to hide before remembering I don't even know where I am. My head is spinning, pounding. I'm wondering if I've been drugged, and I think that's probably the only explanation. People don't float into the sky. They just don't. And that means I am hallucinating, which means whoever kidnapped me knows a thing or two about stealing kids, which means they're a professional, which means they're a... what's the term? Serial killer. Yeah, that's it. A riot of sound slams into me. I clap my hands over my ears, teeth clenched in agony. It's that same otherworldly bass from the forest, except now it's all around me, throbbing, inescapable. Another bellow joins the cacophony, higher pitched and coming from the opposite direction. They pulse in a rhythm, almost like some counterfeit Morse code. Whatever they are, they've got me surrounded.
Please, I beg them, voice breaking. Just let me go. I swear I won't tell anybody.
Static crackles. It's followed by a sharp squeal of microphone feedback, then the buzz of modulating frequency.
Communication calibrated,
a robotic voice announces.
Subject identified as Homo sapien. Terrestrial location, New Mexico. Language model, English.
There's a pause. It's long enough that I can hear my pulse rushing through my veins. This is it, I think. I'm going to die. Stuff like this doesn't happen to kids who live to tell the tale. The voice speaks.
Can you understand us, Homo sapien?
Yes?
I croak.
Communication link established. Proceed with...
Sorry,
I interject weakly. Can you maybe turn on the lights?
The lights?
Yes, please.
The way I see it, the only thing worse than being murdered is being murdered in the dark. An electronic hum fills the air. It's followed by a flicker of illumination. I blink as a warm glow floods the chamber, and my stomach coils into knots. I'm standing in a labyrinth of vats, massive glass containers filled with murky, bubbling fluid. Tubes snake out from them. They're converging on a console with a holographic display and an array of bizarre dials.
Is this level of luminance sufficient?
The voice inquires.
I whirl around, and my breath catches in my throat.
In front of me is something that doesn't exist. It can't exist. It's 10 feet tall, maybe more. It's got teeth like a shark, claws longer than my forearm, and a freaking tail.
You're a monster, I stammer. A dinosaur.
Incorrect,
another voice interjects.
We are the chosen, life forms from a distant galaxy that have come to save your species.
The new voice belongs to another creature, identical to the first, maw fangs, claws, and scaled skin. They converge in the center of the vat maze, their enormous eyes fixated on me. Each eye contains countless pupils, expanding like living ink blots.
I've been abducted, I gasp, struggling to breathe. Aliens are real, and I've been abducted.
Correct.
The alien with deep gray scales confirms. Its counterpart, shimmering in soft teal, looms beside it. Gray's arm illuminates with a holographic display, which it studies intently.
Readings indicate heightened cortisol levels and increased adrenal flow. Source, fight or flight response. Determination, irrational. You have neither the option to fight or flee, human. Compliance without further physical strain would be optimal. Do you concur?
I gape at them, words failing me. What is this, the alien equivalent of my Miranda rights?
Human?
Gray prompts, its multitude of pupils pulsing impatiently.
Look, I know what this is about, I stammer, crossing my legs and inching away.
You're going to probe me. I've seen the movies, but I just want you to know that I'm a lousy specimen. There are way better people to probe. Michael Keaton, for instance. He was awesome in Batman, and I bet you he's...
Incorrect.
Teal booms.
We are cognizant of the concept you reference, but do not engage in such primitive behavior. We seek merely to harvest your DNA.
Its claw taps one of the bubbling vats. The murky fluid clears, and a man floats within, his lower half dissolved, intestines drifting freely in the viscous fluid. Jesus Christ, I choke out.
Unlikely,
Teal rumbles.
This specimen was procured mere days ago, 3,213 kilometers west of Nazareth.
I mean, you're killing people. Teal lumbers across the chamber, its massive form leaving fleeting indentations in the strange, self-healing metal floor. It rests a clawed hand on the computer console.
Your concern is unwarranted, human. Your absence will be accounted for. A clone will assume your life, preventing familial disruption and dissolution of social order.
It's almost too much to wrap my head around. No, scratch that. It's way too much to wrap my head around. So, let me get this straight, I say, fighting the rising nausea. You're going to kill me to, what, save the world?
We'll deconstruct you to ensure human salvation,
Teal corrects. My words crumble into incoherence. The room starts to warp, my vision blurring. My chest constricts, and a piercing ringing fills my ears. No, I plead weakly. Don't do this. I stumble, crashing against another vat. A woman floats inside, who's seen better days. Pieces of her skull have been eaten away, the wrinkles of her brain now visible beneath.
Specimen's heart rate is critical,
Gray announces, but the words barely register. I don't even notice as Gray approaches, seizing my wrist and pressing a device into my palm. A brief sting, and then an icy chill spreads through my hand. I look up at Gray, my vision tripling. Nausea and delirium overwhelm me. What did you do? I mumble. But even as I speak, I wonder why I bothered asking. Suddenly, everything feels fine? No, better than fine. What was I so worked up about anyway? It's just a couple of giant space monsters and some floating corpses. No biggie.
You've been administered a sedative,
Gray explains. Oh, I reply, a dopey grin on my face. Cool. Gray keeps tapping at the display on its forearm, keeps talking all official and serious.
Cortisol levels reduced, adrenal response suppressed. Biometric readings indicate suitable levels of suggestibility. Verdict? Proceed. Affirmative,
Teal says from the main console. You guys need to, chillax, I giggle. Like you're super uptight. My eyes drift closed and I'm lost in bliss. It's like floating on a sun-warmed lake, my heart overflowing with all the love in the world. This must be paradise. If only my sister could experience this before she dies.
Pulse quickening,
Gray says sharply. Hope, my sister, my dying sister, alone in that sterile hospital room, wondering why her little brother abandoned her.
Sedation effect diminishing,
Gray warns, its tone urgent.
Readings to 98%, 94%, emotional instability approaching critical levels, hormones in flux, harvest viability status compromised.
Hope, I gasp, the haze lifting. You have to send me back. I need to get to the hospital. Say goodbye to my sister. Please, she's dying and she needs me. Gray presses the device to my other hand, another wave of artificial calm washing over me.
Invalid concern,
it drones.
Your clone will be an exact replica, retaining all memories. It will seamlessly continue your existence. Conclusion, your expiring sibling will receive appropriate support before decomposition. Is this satisfactory?
No, I groan, fighting the double dose of sedative with everything I've got. I never agreed to this, so just put me back. Find somebody else.
Impossible.
Teal growls from the console.
Insufficient time. We must harvest your DNA to aid in human salvation. He's coming.
Who's coming? I demand. Teal's enormous eyes narrow, its myriad pupils contracting to pinpoints.
Invalid query. Information too sensitive for dissemination. Rebuttal.
Gray interjects.
Clone's memory can be altered. Current biometrics indicate immense emotional distress, compromising harvest success by 34% and rising. Solution? Permit subjects to comprehend purpose of sacrifice. Outcome? Emotional closure and enhanced probability of project success.
Teal turns back to the console.
Rebuttal accepted. Proceed.
Gray crouches before me, its scaly digits pressing against my temples.
Prepare for disorientation,
it warns.
You will experience physical discomfort resulting from hyper-simulation. After, you will comprehend the horror that awaits your species in the dark.
Present day. I bolt upright, gasping. Another nightmare. The same crap that's haunted me for 3 decades now. Except, it wasn't, was it? I rake my fingers through my graying hair, gulping air like a drowning man. My trembling hand seizes the water glass on the nightstand, nearly spilling it. This dream was different, vivid. I saw things that I've never dreamed before. Things that felt closer to memories than hallucinations. And yet... Bzzz, bzzz. My phone vibrates angrily. I fumble for it, my hand shaking so violently I almost drop the damn thing before it reaches my ear. What's it? I grumble, voice thick with sleep.
What is it?
A female voice mocks.
Do me a favor and go fuck yourself, Mitchell. I've been tearing my hair out for the last 2 hours while you've been off in dreamland banging Dolly Parton.
I heave a sigh. My boss, Lisa, charming as ever. Dolly Parton, I mutter, rubbing my eyes. Isn't she pushing 80 now, Lise?
How the hell should I know? Lisa snaps. Point is, she's a babe. You'd screw her. I'd screw her. The whole world...
Are you drunk? Hell, who am I kidding? It's 3 a.m. on a Saturday. Of course you're drunk.
Christ, if only, she says, and I can almost hear her scowl. Listen, are you sitting down right now?
I yawn cavernously.
Safe to assume, since you just woke me up.
She gives a humorless chuckle.
Yeah, about that. Pretty much nothing is safe to assume, not anymore.
Lisa launches into a rapid-fire briefing. Her words rattle through the speaker like automatic gunfire. From the background chatter, I gather she's addressing more than just me, probably briefing a team of stone-faced government types as she power-walks down some sterile hallway.
Got all that?
She asks after 10 minutes of non-stop verbal diarrhea. I think so. Something about a shitstorm. Something about an F-35. Apparently, the Air Force shot down a UAP an hour ago, which is how we say UFO these days to avoid getting laughed out of the room. And of course, it had to happen in New Mexico, my backyard. This calls for a liter of coffee. Probably 2. I stumble into the kitchen, set a pot brewing, and stay on the line while Lisa continues barking orders at her underlings.
I don't care what it takes, Mallory. Make it happen. Do I look like I'm fucking laughing, Douglas? O'Reilly, if you publish this, I swear to God, I'll tear off your dick and...
1 cream, 2 sugars. My spoon clinks against the mug as Lisa's voice blares through the speaker.
Mitchell, still there?
She rattles off coordinates. I take a swig of scalding Java, barely registering the burn on my tongue. My fingers punch the numbers into my laptop, bringing up the crash site of the so-called UAP. I spew coffee across the screen.
Did I just hear you throw up? Lisa asks.
No.
I did, didn't I?
I wipe the screen clean with my bathrobe sleeve.
You sure you got those numbers right? Am I sure?
She says, incredulous.
Yes, I'm bloody sure. I've been gnawing my nails for the past hour, Mitchell. My manicurist is going to think I've taken up meth. This isn't some Chinese spy balloon. This is the real deal. A genuine fucking UFO. So suit up and get ready to launch. I've got a bird on the way.
The microwave clock blinks 3:34 a.m. My stomach growls in protest. Can you give me 10 minutes for breakfast? Click. The line goes dead. Figures. I take a deep breath, try to rationalize this. There's got to be some mistake here, some error. The coordinates Lisa gave can't be accurate because they're not pointing to some barren stretch near Roswell or Eglin. They're pointing to a forest, a cluster of trees with a rickety old bridge and a winding dirt trail. They're pointing to a place where I used to pedal my bike as a kid. Outside, there's a drum roll of helicopter blades. Time to go. I bolt upstairs, throw on my suit, and hurtle out the door, still wrestling with my jacket sleeve. A half-eaten cheese bagel dangles from my teeth. I board the chopper in a daze. We rocket towards the crash site like we're trying to outrun a cruise missile, and I can't even bring myself to finish the bagel. I'm feeling sick, woozy. I'm watching the lights of the countryside drift by, and it occurs to me that from all the way up here, in the dead of night, those lights almost look like stars. I'm wondering how long it'd take to snuff them out. I'm wondering how long it'd take to burn a whole galaxy to ashes or crush a universe in the palm of my hand. Things to consider. The closer we get to the crash site, the worse my thoughts become. They're spiraling, bordering on obsessive. I'm tangoing with darkness. Radio chatter comes through the comm line in a gargle of static, and I catch bits and pieces. They're talking aliens, extraterrestrials. They're talking about things that don't exist, and the whole time I'm just trying to control my bladder. I'm drowning in hypotheticals. What happens, I wonder, if I lose my mind between here and the crash site? What's the protocol for that? Do they pull me from the mission? Do I get a night off? The week? Everything okay, sir? It's the co-pilot. She's turned around in her seat, looking at me like she's worried I'm going to make a mess on her deck. You look a bit queasy, she says. Not much of a frequent flyer, I'm guessing. My muscles work overtime to yank my mouth into a smile. I'm fine. Not thrilled to be working on a weekend, but what can you do, right? She grins. Tell me about it. I'm Kennedy, by the way. Isaiah, I manage. Nice to meet you. The guy in the chair next to me is Jono. Jono offers a casual wave. How much further to the crash site? I ask, fighting to keep my voice steady. Kennedy furrows her brow. 10 minutes, give or take, maybe 12. All depends on whether Jono here grows a pair and stops piloting this bird like my grandma. She gives him a playful jab on the shoulder. Jono chuckles. Can you believe I've got to fly with this witch? God help me, she'd be better off on a broomstick. They share a laugh. I try to join in, try to blend in. But the whole time I'm thinking about how dry my mouth feels, how badly my hands are shaking in my lap. The longer I'm spending in this helicopter, the more I'm coming undone. It's the memories, I think. The memories of my nightmare that are trickling into my thoughts like psychic cyanide. I'm remembering what I saw in my dream. Awful things. Things more terrible than words can describe, and with each passing moment, those things seem less impossible and more inevitable. The radio buzzes. It keeps buzzing, keeps bombarding us with transmissions about advanced metal alloys, about non-human technology. Nearly there, Jono announces. 8 minutes to touchdown. 5. 4. Holy, Kennedy breathes at the 3-minute mark. Are you seeing this? It's impossible to miss. There's a plume of smoke rising from a forest on the edge of town, and all amongst the branches are the ghosts of dying flames. Beyond the canopy, a constellation of industrial lamps traces a mile-long path from a checkpoint at the wood's edge to its heart, following a swath of devastation through the trees. What the hell is that? Jono asks, his voice tight. Kennedy leans forward, her face pressed against the cockpit glass. The blood drains from her features, leaving her ghostly pale in the dim light. That's not one of ours, she whispers, her words barely a breath. Sure isn't, Jono mutters, his knuckles white on the controls. I lurch from my seat, wedging myself between them to peer down. My jaw clenches. Below us stretches an ocean of splintered lumber, and at its center lies something colossal. It's the size of an aircraft carrier, its surface rippling and shimmering, reflecting the glow of the flickering fires as if forged from liquid metal.
Son of a bitch, Kennedy breathes. I thought all that radio chatter was bullshit, but this is the real deal, isn't it? That's a goddamn spaceship.
Jono only manages a shaking nod. I try to speak, to offer some explanation or reassurance, but my voice fails me. As we circle above the metallic Leviathan, a chill runs down my spine. I realize we've just crossed a threshold, the kind there's no coming back from, because that thing that we're looking at doesn't belong to this world. It belongs to me, to my nightmares. But as hard as I try, I can't seem to wake up from this dream.
The Recall. Gray's scaly fingers connect with my temples, and static crackles across my skull. I'm convulsing, frothing at the mouth, choking on my own breath. I'm pretty sure I'm going to die, but then, poof, it all vanishes. After that, I'm just falling. Plummeting through the atmosphere of my own mind, I crash into a dimension beyond myself, beyond everything. Images flash. They spin up like a cosmic film reel, bombarding my consciousness from every angle. They're everywhere, inescapable. Weirdly, it's as if I'm inhabiting these moments, every sensation, sight, sound, smell, collapsing into a singular, overwhelming experience. Gray called this disorienting. I think he might have undersold it. Then, just when I know I can't take another second of this chaos, it decelerates. The visual hurricane calms from a Category 5 to a 3. Moments float to the surface. Others sink out of sight. Like a sponge, my mind starts absorbing information, everything from quantum physics to the lyrical discography of Shania Twain. Knowledge becomes trivial. As soon as I want to know something, I just reach out and take it. It's pretty sweet. But something catches my attention. A series of lights shimmer in my lake of thought, gleaming jewels beckoning to me. That's what I'm after. I don't know how I know this, I just do. I sorta know everything now. So I reach out, touch one. Big mistake. Information pummels me. It carpet bombs my mind, blowing up my consciousness and making the last round of hyperstimulation feel like I was watching paint dry. I think I'm disintegrating. It's maybe the worst thing I've ever felt, and yet, in the madness of it all, the entire history of the cosmos unfolds before me. I see it. All of it. Gray and Teal? Not monsters. They're members of an alien race called the Vitar. Their technology makes ours look like sticks and stones, and I guess they've existed for billions of years. Holy hell. They've accomplished mind-boggling feats in that time. Everything from mastering faster-than-light travel to creating edible rocks and, of course, mapping the entirety of the cosmos. They've been busy, with a capital B. And that's just scratching the surface. The revelations don't let up. They keep coming and coming. I see their sprawling civilization, their gargantuan spaceships bristling with awesome guns, their high council, and... And then I see tragedy. I watch as the Vitarian race makes two terrible discoveries. First, they learn they are alone in the universe. Second, they discover their entire species is dying. How? Let me explain. Near the edge of space, a Vitarian research vessel discovers life, only it's not the intelligent kind. Far from it. This life is microbial, viral, and it infects the Vitarian explorers. They're quarantined, observed, and you know what they discovered about this strange alien virus? They discovered it was pretty great. In fact, it's just what they've been looking for. Before long, Vitarians across the cosmos are lining up to be infected. Within a century, their entire species are carriers. It jumps between them like the common cold. They don't mind, though, not one bit. Why? Because this virus comes with a satisfaction guarantee. Biological immortality. Now there's a deal. The trouble is, these Vitar don't work like humans do. They don't mate, make babies, sleep, wake up, and do it again. No, these Vitar lay eggs, and only certain members of their species lay eggs. And what's more, they only lay eggs during a specific molting period at the end of their life cycles. See what I'm getting at? Immortality or laying eggs. Pick one. You can't have both if you're the Vitar. But by the time they figure this out, this virus has infected every last colony of their civilization. Unable to reproduce, their population enters freefall. It develops what's known as an existential crisis. And if there's one thing civil society hates, it's dealing with an existential crisis. Trust me, I know everything now. Anyway, tempers flare, emotions run hot. Things are said that maybe shouldn't have been, and that brings us to the crux of the Vitarian dilemma. War. And lots of it. Whole worlds erupt into conflict, galaxies become battlefields, and entire solar systems are laid to cosmic ash. If you thought nuclear weapons were bad, consider what happens when a moon is kicked out of orbit into the surface of a planet. It ain't pretty. Hell, as the fighting escalates, the stars themselves become weapons. The Vitar discover that if you can just push one toward instability, well, boom, there goes the neighborhood. This penchant for galaxy brain problem-solving decimates their population to mere billions. Over a millennium, the Vitar plummet from an intergalactic empire to a handful of clans clinging to a single world in some backwater system. Still with me? I know it's a lot to process, but trust me, it's crucial. So, the Vitar essentially self-destruct, obliterating each other out of sheer frustration. The survivors, traumatized by the horrors wrought by their technology, swing hard towards spiritualism. Cults sprout like a fungus. Various sects compete, but one ultimately devours the rest. The Way of the Chosen. These guys peddle the ultimate snake oil, an end to Vitarian suffering. No more existential dread, no more war, no more planetary billiards with moons. It's a good sales pitch. All the Vitar need to do is swallow their three-step program. 1. Embrace your superiority. You're the universe's only intelligent life, so own it. 2. Endure the endless. Immortality is your final test. Buck up and find a hobby. 3. Achieve cosmic nirvana. Survive until the heat death of the universe and attain rapture. Terms and conditions apply, limited availability. Nirvana will be offered on a first-come, first-serve basis. Believe it or not, it's a smash hit. The Vitarians flock to the Way in droves, desperate for purpose and a break from their all-consuming rage. Within a decade, the Chosen seize control across all colonies, unifying the warring factions and establishing an uneasy peace. Sounds great, right? The catch: all non-believers must be exiled. It's for the greater good, they claim, the only way to prevent future conflict. And maybe they're right. After all, this is a species that knows how quickly disagreements can spiral toward interstellar Armageddon. So, dissenters are given their marching orders. Here's a spacecraft, some supplies. Now scram. Live however you want, wherever you want. Just not on Vitar. It's not exactly kumbaya, but there are worse ways to run a theocracy. Among the exiles is a scientist known in collective memory as the Heretic. It's an apt name, almost poetic given what his destiny has in store for him, but we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. The Heretic fancies himself a philosopher. He ponders the big questions, like, what happens after the Vitar kick the bucket and intelligent life vanishes from the universe? He concludes that it's curtains, not just for the Vitar, but for the universe itself. After all, if there's no consciousness left to perceive it, does the universe even exist? To the Heretic, this lights-out scenario is a bit of a bummer, and if there's one thing the Heretic won't stand for, it's bummers. So, he rolls up his sleeves, gets to work. The Heretic hatches a plan. It's not exactly foolproof. Hell, it's barely even sane. The odds of success are astronomical, and it's definitely skirting some ethical boundaries. But it's a plan nonetheless. It's simple, straightforward. The Heretic reasons that the Vitarians are the universe's sole sentient beings, facing extinction due to incurable sterilization. It's inevitable, inescapable. So, what's left on the table? Just one wild card play. The Heretic charts a course for a distant star system, one with a promising sun and a Goldilocks planet ripe with potential. He sets his sights on destiny. And that's where our nightmare begins. Present day. The helicopter touches down in a clearing that shouldn't exist. I step out to find a forest that's broken, smoldering, one that's cleaved in two with a cloud of cinders in its wake. This isn't how I remember this place. Not at all. I remember a wooden bridge over a lazy creek, and tall trees that... Mitchell! Lisa. Of course it's Lisa. She's barreling towards me, phone glued to one ear, her free hand slicing through the air like a metronome gone berserk. Mitchell, over here! She's bulldozing through a sea of personnel, stern-faced government types in crisp suits and military fatigues. They're swarming everywhere, 1,000 different tasks underway, all of their voices breaking with anxious unease. At least I'm in good company. Lisa squeezes past a square-jawed general, doubling over with her hands on her knees, gasping for air.
What the hell took you so long? She wheezes. It's been hours.
I glance at my watch, puzzled. It's been 30 minutes, 38 actually. She smacks her forehead.
Shit, time dilation.
Time what?
We've discovered that time operates differently inside the UAP, she explains, waving off my confusion. Look, it doesn't matter. Just follow me. I'll fill you in on the way.
We take a surreal stroll through the newest gully in America. The ground is a minefield of UAP fragments, pieces of soft metal that hazmat teams are scooping into clear bags like the world's worst Easter egg hunt. My stomach is in my throat. A shadow passes overhead, and I look up to see helicopters unfurling a massive tarp across the forest canopy.
That's to keep the satellites out, Lisa explains, gesturing skyward. The last thing we need is China getting wind of this, or, God forbid, Google fucking Maps.
Feels like we might be a little late on that, I mutter. Lisa wags a finger in my face.
Don't you start with me. The Pentagon's already breathing down my neck as if I didn't get here as fast as humanly possible.
She contorts her face, mimicking the Secretary of Defense.
What exactly did we shoot down? Is it Chinese? Are we going to war?
If you think that's bad, I say, just wait until the media wakes up. Or worse, the kids with smartphones. She groans, running a hand through frizzy chestnut hair.
Don't remind me. I should have kept on as an accountant. I'd still be in bed right now, thinking of all the ways I could jump off a bridge tomorrow. You know, like a normal person. But no, I had to follow my dreams. Fuck me. As we push deeper, the smoke thins, revealing a shape through the hazy veil. The colossal silhouette of an oval craft, smoldering amidst the devastated trees. It's breathtaking. Large enough to pass for a football stadium and round enough to sell the illusion. So this is it, I mutter, suddenly lightheaded, woozy. I fumble with my tie, loosening it with a desperate tug, but it does little to free whatever's stuck in my throat. This is it, Lisa confirms with a nervous chuckle. A bona fide flying saucer. I mean, geez, you'd think these aliens never heard of a bad cliche. Memories crawl up from my psyche, but I wrestle them back down. I keep telling myself that there's got to be more to this, some other explanation. Maybe this is some other alien spaceship, and my dreams really are just dreams. What do you need? Lisa asks, studying me. Huh? You look like you're going to throw up, so what do you need? Dramamine? Gravol? She glances around furtively, then reaches into her jacket, pulling out a flask with a mischievous wiggle. A dash of liquid courage, maybe? I don't drink. Never been a better time to start. I'll pass. Well, I won't. She lifts the flask to her lips, takes the kind of swig that'd make my deadbeat father lift an eyebrow. A trickle of whiskey runs down her chin. Finally, she comes up for air, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand before tucking the flask away. She exhales sharply, the scent of bourbon hanging in the air. Right. So before we jump inside that circus, I want you to take a few deep breaths. Get your shit together. We've already had a couple, incidents. Incidents? I ask warily. Oh yeah, big time. You do yoga at all? I shake my head. Well, you should. It's great for shit like this. Kills stress like nothing else. I can get you a discount at my studio, but only on Tuesday and Thursdays. And no hot yoga. Interested? I'll consider it. You mentioned incidents? Oh, right. She starts ticking them off on her fingers. So far, we've had two Marines piss themselves, one lieutenant hurl all over what I'm like 90% sure was some kind of alien artifact, and... Oh God, Mitchell, somebody shat their fucking pants. No lie? Lisa laughs weakly, her face suddenly pale. Can you believe that? I mean, Christ, now the whole UAP reeks of chili dogs and somebody's Chipotle-ringed asshole. I grimace. Spare me the details next time, Lise. That's disgusting. No, a fart is disgusting, Mitchell. This... Lisa shivers, her eyes glazing over at the memory of it. This was something else entirely. Anyway, if I didn't warn you, you'd figure it out the second you walked in. That stench is lingering. Fantastic, I mutter. We halt at a checkpoint. Lisa flashes her badge and I follow suit. A sergeant with a crew cut, looking like he'd rather be anywhere else, takes them, scans them, and then delivers the standard spiel through a stifled yawn. No photos, no touching, no running, no yelling, no wandering into sections the hazmat teams haven't cleared for contagions, and absolutely no pocketing alien technology as souvenirs. It's just no, all the way down. Finally, he finishes his rundown and takes a deep breath. One more thing, he adds, giving the knife hand gesture to a row of porta potties. If nature calls, I'd answer it now. We've had some incidents. I give Lisa a sidelong glance. So I've heard. Lisa slips me a smirk as we pass the checkpoint. The entrance to the UAP is tough to miss. It's the gaping hole the F-35 left in its hull when it blew it out of the sky. There's a makeshift ramp leading up to it. We pass throngs of people coming and going, each of them more ashen-faced than the last. You sure you're good? Lisa asks. Peachy, I tell her. Aha, you don't look peachy. Weird, look harder. She exhales, exasperated. Look, Mitchell, I'm not trying to be a bitch. I just want to make sure you're prepared. Prepared for what? I say, folding my arms. Lisa's teeth worry at her lower lip, her entire body thrumming with barely contained energy.
Nothing,
she chirps unconvincingly. Lise, I groan. Spill it.
Bodies!
The word explodes from her face, eyes alight with ghoulish glee.
They've got fucking bodies in vats, Mitchell. It's insane. Total X-Files shit. Honestly, you're gonna love it. Or hate it. I don't know. Either way, there's not enough therapy in the world for you to get over this. You're in for a lifetime of nightmares. Guaranteed.
She slings an arm over my shoulder, steering me towards the shrouded entrance.
That means no more Dolly Parton for you.
The Recall. The heretic paints life in his image, and Earth is his canvas. His first brushstrokes are behemoths, colossal reptiles that roam a primordial world, but these are rough drafts of his grand design. He studies them, learns from them, he leverages them to unravel the enigma of complex intelligence, but fate has other threads to weave. A surveillance drone drifts by the Earth, a Vitarian relic. It's charting a repeating course, one set long before the Vitarian War, and now it's relaying its data to the last colony in existence. The heretic's vessel crackles with an incoming transmission, a collect call from 12 billion light-years away.
Hello?
He answers. It's the Chosen High Council. They aren't pleased. To them, the creation of life is a sacred honor reserved for their deity, the Distant One. And so, the heretic has their attention, and not in a good way.
Cease this, they order.
I can explain, he tells them.
Don't bother, they growl.
Please, listen, he pleads.
But the line goes dead, leaving only the hum of distant stars. The heretic's mind races with calculations. 2 weeks, he estimates. He has 2 weeks before the Chosen arrive to execute him, and so he flees to a neighboring star system. The Chosen arrive. They search for him, but find nothing. Before they leave, though, they decide to clean up the heretic's blasphemy. They redirect a passing asteroid toward the Earth, obliterating it in fire and ash. Time marches on. Years bleed into centuries, and centuries into millennia. The weight of his loss hangs heavy on the heretic's conscience, driving him back to Earth. He seeks closure, a chance to pay respects to the life he condemned. So, he returns, and his sorrow becomes hope. Life, in its stubborn persistence, has flourished. It's thrived, evolved, and adapted. Yet, the creatures that now inhabit Earth aren't the offspring of his colossal prototypes. Instead, they're the descendants of the tiny mammals he created as their sustenance. These new beings, humans, captivate the heretic. Their powerful brains, dexterous hands, and upright gait mirror his own Vitarian form. He watches, fascinated, as they form rudimentary societies, birth the first stuttering languages, and craft primitive technologies. In these fledgling humans, the heretic sees the future stewards of the universe. If only the Chosen weren't looming. The heretic knows they'll return, realizing their genocide was incomplete. This time, they won't hold back. Earth will be reduced to cosmic rubble, floating amid crystallized blood. So the heretic gets to work. Strategies whir through his mind, each more desperate than the last. He has but one ship, no weapons. The odds seem insurmountable. Then, inspiration strikes. Humans have an edge. Adaptability, swift evolution. They could potentially match the Vitarian's intellect given time, but time is a luxury the heretic can ill afford. Another surveillance drone could drift past Earth any day now, and so he needs to act, intervene, spike humanity's gene pool, rig the results. He'll need to give his children more than a push. He'll have to throw them down the evolutionary stairwell if they have any hope of matching the Vitarians. So he devises a solution. It starts by forging a man, one shaped from the genetic clay of thousands. Each strand of his DNA will be carefully selected, isolating the potential for runaway evolution. But he won't just be a human. No, his flesh is to be interwoven with the heretic's own Vitarian essence, enough to unlock the collective recall, to flood his mind with eons of cosmic memory. The man will become a living catalyst, a walking singularity. His genes will then spread through humanity like a virus of metamorphosis, each generation leaping forward, their minds racing ever faster toward a terrible apex. Project Runaway. That's the name the heretic gives it, and he believes, in his heart, that it will result in the liberation of humanity. He believes it will bring about the salvation of the universe. And in this, he has made the worst miscalculation since the dawn of time. Present day. Watch your step, Lisa warns. We push through a forest of plastic tassels, blinded by the glare of industrial work lamps. We're standing in a circular chamber, a hub with corridors spiraling outward like the spokes of an alien wheel. The spacecraft is a hive of activity. Personnel in biohazard suits and military fatigue swarm around us, buzzing with urgency and barely contained panic. Teams seal off entrances with sheets of plastic wrap, while other teams are scribbling labels, scotch-taping them above the doorways labeled A through G. "Take it in," Lisa says, closing her eyes and breathing deep. "We're inside a UFO, a real one. Makes you feel like Agent K or Dana Scully or..." "Yeah, I get it," I mutter. I sulk forward, the heel of my shoe sinking into the soft metal with every step, almost like I'm walking over a mattress. I hate how familiar it feels. Lisa jogs to catch up. "Hey, Mitchell," she says. "Huh? Anybody ever tell you you're a total drag?" "Most people, yeah." "Great. Just making sure." We head down a corridor labeled D. Lisa explains we're looking for somebody named Major Luca. Apparently, Luca called her a few minutes before my helicopter touched down, said she had something big to show us, something crazy. "By crazy, do you mean corpses and vats?" I ask. "Nope, I mean bodies," Lisa tells me. "Bodies." A nod. "Apparently of the non-human variety, if you can believe it." I feel the color drain from my face. We venture deeper, twisting through corridors D2, D4, and D7, and each corridor feels worse than the last. My heart is pounding like a war drum. I nod mechanically as Lisa rattles off details about the UAP, about what the teams were passing her up to, but internally, I'm having a breakdown. The further we get into the spacecraft, the more I'm wondering how much of my dreams were dreams. The more I wonder if all I am is just some clone with a badge. "What did the bodies look like?" I hear myself ask, voice hoarse. "The dead aliens, I mean." Lisa's laugh is sharp, pointed. "No clue. I'd put money on little green men, though. Fits the whole flying saucer motif, don't you think?" "Yeah," I manage, swallowing hard. "Suppose it would." Lisa gets a call over the radio. It's the Pentagon. Apparently, we've got an ironclad alibi to deal with the journalists, something banal enough to keep them far from the crash site. As for the public, we're going to feed them some freshly plucked political controversy, something juicy enough to keep them distracted, fighting. But I'm too deep in my thoughts to catch specifics. I'm caught up in my own mind, recalling a memory that was meant to be a dream. I'm remembering him, the runaway. And the more that I remember, the more I want to forget. The recall. The first time the runaway opens his eyes, he's 20 years old. The jungle around him pulses with life, a kaleidoscope of green pierced by shafts of gold. His naked skin prickles under the gaze of the sun, its ultraviolet rays baptizing him in fire and sweat. He has no instructions, no guidance. This world is entirely new to him, and in his stomach flutters the first ghosts of adrenaline. The runaway rises to his feet. His first step is a stagger, a graceless lurch that sends him sprawling into the lush undergrowth. Pain, that most ancient of teachers, introduces itself. It's harder than it looks, walking when you've never done it before, but eventually he gets the picture. For him, it gets easier by the second. After only an hour, the runaway has learned to run, to sprint. He's dashing through the ferns, leaping from tree to tree with a grace bordering on simian. His stomach howls, a cavernous emptiness demanding to be filled. Food. He must find food. But what to eat in this verdant labyrinth? By his third hour alive, the runaway has learned to forage. By his sixth, he has learned to die. He writhes upon the ground, every nerve screaming as his body wages war against a toxic feast. The berries burn his stomach. They make his tongue swell and his skin glisten with a fever sweat. But as the seconds march on, his agony fades. His cellular structure begins to realign, his enzymes mutating, and within moments, the poison has become his fuel. He gets back to his feet, reborn. The runaway takes his first breath, a whole new creature, subtly improved by evolution's kiss. Twilight paints the jungle. The runaway collects wild game from his crudely made traps. The heretic, observing from afar, marvels at his creation so easily tapping into the collective recall. The runaway's hands move with ancestral memory, skinning his catch and kindling fire as if he'd done so for a thousand lifetimes. A week passes, and the runaway learns what it means to be food. A pack of wolves ambush him while he sleeps. Their eyes gleam in the night. Saliva drips from their gnashing jaws. Their throats rumble with a promise of violence, their paws padding ever closer as their haunches lift into the air, ready to lunge. But the runaway is unconcerned. A week is a long time for a man like him, and by now he has well learned how to handle his fear, how to subdue it, command it. Now, his fear serves him. His muscles tense, his hands flexing into calloused fists. He follows the gray beasts with his eyes, watching as they prowl nearer and nearer. The large one, he thinks. The large wolf will engage first, and then the rest will follow, but only if he permits it. The runaway strikes first. He darts forward, his feet leaving a cloud of dirt in his wake. By the time the first scatter of dirt falls, he has already brought his fist down on the alpha of the pack, his blow connecting with its skull in a crack of thunder. The colossal canine stumbles. It whines. The others draw back, pupils wide as the runaway grabs hold of the patriarch's jaws, pulling them apart with everything he has. Another crack of thunder. A dying yelp. The remaining wolves scatter, fleeing into the trees as their champion hits the ground. The runaway's message is clear. He is the predator, and they are his prey. As weeks bleed into months, the runaway's evolution accelerates beyond all comprehension. At 6 weeks, his body is a masterpiece of efficiency. Nutrition is rendered an afterthought, with only a handful of berries sustaining him for days on end, his cells multiplying every iota of their energy. By 10 weeks, oxygen itself becomes optional. His lungs, once slaves to the rhythm of breath, rest for hours at a time. He plunges into the ocean's depths, racing with sharks in the midnight zone, plucking delicacies from the seafloor as casually as one might pick apples from a tree. On the anniversary of his awakening, the runaway transcends even the specter of mortality. His DNA, once bound by the cruel arrhythmic of cellular division, now replicates flawlessly. Age becomes a concept as foreign to him as death. 5 years pass, and the universe bends to his will. Atoms dance at his command, reality reshaping itself at his merest whim. To him, the laws of physics are little more than suggestions. He soars through the sky on wings of thought, peers into the minds of lesser beings as easily as one might read a book. He has become a god in flesh, the most powerful entity to ever grace existence. And as the heretic watches this, he feels no fear, not even a phantom of concern. The runaway has proven himself to be kind, compassionate. As the decades roll by, the runaway's appetite for violence diminishes. Even the savagery of his fellow human beings, their bloodlust and petty cruelties, becomes too much for him to bear. He retreats from their world, seeking solitude in nature. Yet humanity, in its endless thirst for meaning, continues to seek him out. They scale treacherous peaks and hack through dense jungles, desperate for a glimpse, a touch, a word spoken from the mouth of this miracle. Some fall to their knees in worship. Others spit curses and threats. To the runaway, they are one and the same. Lost children, fumbling in the dark. Their instincts, once his own, now seem as foreign as the language of ants. He has evolved beyond them, becoming something else. No longer kin, but a distant observer. Yet for all his power, for all his transcendence, there is turmoil within him, a deep loneliness. It gnaws at him, reminding the runaway of his mortality, his human core. He seeks answers in meditation, sometimes sinking to the ocean floor, other times soaring among the clouds to escape the chaos of the world. And it's during one such meditation, suspended between heaven and earth, that the runaway turns his gaze to the stars. He wonders if there could be others out there, others like him. And like an answer to a prayer, he sees it. A figure, reptilian and humanoid, encased in a shelter made of polished ore. It drifts amid the rings of a gas giant, Saturn, though the runaway doesn't yet know this name. The creature stares back through a curious device, its gaze piercing light years. In that moment, the runaway makes a decision. It's a decision that will change the tide of history, that will give birth to the suffering of billions, that will risk the destruction of everything that ever was. But the runaway is unaware of these things. He knows only that he is lonely and that he does not wish to be. And so, he flies. It is not a simple journey, reaching this creature in the stars. The runaway presses up against the Earth's atmosphere and his body is incinerated. But like a phoenix, he is reborn from the ashes, stronger, more resilient. On his second attempt, the runaway breaks through the atmosphere only to discover a new challenge, the vacuum of space. Yet, this vacuum has its benefits. It offers him the sort of silence that allows him to center his mind, to focus in new and more profound ways, and so, as he sets his sights on Saturn, he begins to pick up speed. Soon, he's not merely flying, he's blazing across the solar system, a comet of potential racing toward fate. In the span of a month, he traverses distances that would take conventional spacecraft years. And then, he arrives. The heretic's ship hangs before him, a metallic bubble in the black ocean of asteroids. The runaway reaches out, rapping his knuckles against the hull. Thunk, thunk. The ship's exterior shimmers, becoming transparent. The reptilian thing he'd seen from Earth bows its head in greeting, then ushers him inside. "Hello," the being rumbles in the ancient tongue of man. The runaway studies this strange creature, his mind working to decipher its unfamiliar sounds. When he responds, it's not in the language of man, but in the deep, resonant bass of Vitarian. "Hello," he begins, the word feeling strange on his tongue. "Your language is curious.
but I believe I can master it. Tell me, who are you? Why have you been observing me?
The being, the heretic, sees no point in deception. After all, the runaway could pluck the truth from his mind as easily as picking a flower. So, he lays bare everything. The extinction of the Vitarians, humanity's cosmic inheritance, and the runaway's pivotal role in it all.
Do you have any questions? The heretic asks, his tale concluded.
Many, the runaway replies, his voice a mix of wonder and trepidation.
Above all, why do you fear me?
I do not.
You do, the runaway insists. I see it reflected in your thoughts, along with hatred, disgust.
The heretic's pupils pulse with resignation, his shoulders sagging under an invisible weight.
Of course, I should have anticipated this.
The runaway tilts his head, curious.
The fear, hatred, and disgust you perceive, none of it belongs to me,
the heretic explains.
What you sense are echoes from the collective recall, a shared knowledge passed down by my people. The emotions you're perceiving are actually those of a religious sect, felt by those who follow the way of the chosen.
The runaway's face contorts into a mask of bewilderment.
These followers, they view me as a monster, an abomination?
The heretic hesitates, choosing his words carefully.
Not exactly. To be precise, they do not think of you at all. To safeguard my work, I was forced to sever my connection to the collective epochs ago. But echoes of chosen dogma still remain. To them, my work is blasphemy. And you, my child, are the apex of that blasphemy.
The runaway ponders this.
You say I'm destined to guide humanity's evolution. Is that all I am to you? An instrument?
The heretic reaches out, gently clasping the runaway's shoulder. He smiles, an expression he learned from his study of humans, and speaks softly.
I am a barren creature, ravaged by a virus that has stolen the future of my people. My biological imperative can never be fulfilled. Reproduction is beyond me.
His pupils blot with fragile emotion, splashing like raindrops in his eyes.
No, you are not an instrument.
With slow, awkward, yet earnest movements, the heretic initiates the human ritual of embrace. He wraps his arms around the runaway, holding him close.
You are my legacy, he whispers. You are my son.
12 October, 1991. A gasp escapes me, sharp and sudden. My eyes snap open to find Gray standing before me, his alien pupils pulsing like living ink. In that moment, a tidal wave of realization crashes over me. His name isn't Gray, it's War. And he's ancient, 70 million years old. The same goes for his companion, not Teal, but Kez. Both are devotees of the Way of the Chosen.
Did you see?
War's voice resonates, no longer filtered through a digital translator. The thought transfer has unlocked something in my mind. I can understand the Vitarian language, make sense of the vibrations that previously just seemed like low bass.
I lean forward, my heart racing.
Yes, but there's more, isn't there? What aren't you telling me? Kez's neck twists unnaturally as he fixes us with a stare. His pupils expand and contract rapidly, a reaction I now understand to mean, I'm pissed.
Enough, he growls. Prepare for genetic deconstruction, human. We are done here.
No!
The word erupts from me, a thunderclap that shakes the ship. I'm startled by the power in my own voice, suddenly aware of the raw force behind Vitarian speech.
Clearing my throat, I try again, this time with measured control.
No.
Look, if you want to liquefy me into some kind of cosmic soup, fine, I get it. Salvation of humanity and all that, but you have to prove it's worth it. For all I know, you could be blowing this whole thing out of proportion.
The Vitar exchange glances, a silent conversation playing out in their pupils. Wars shrinks to pinpricks. He's nervous, conflicted.
Further revelations may invite excessive distress, he says carefully. I had hoped a glimpse of cosmic history would suffice.
Well, it didn't, I retort, crossing my arms. So, let's do this again. And this time, don't skimp on the details.
Invalid request, Kez interjects. Such knowledge is beyond your capacity to bear.
I frown, my gaze ping-ponging between them. It's him, isn't it? The runaway. He's the source of all of this, your fear, your mission to save humanity. I might not have all the pieces, but I'm not blind. Your eyes are going haywire like a pair of busted TVs. He's the problem, right? You haven't had any luck dealing with him.
War and Kez remain silent, their downcast expressions speaking volumes.
Look, I press, inhaling deeply. I'm human, too. In a way, I'm like the runaway, just less, well, terrifying. But maybe there's something in those visions that only another human could make sense of. Ever think of that? What if I can spot something you've missed? Isn't that a chance worth taking?
The Vitar fall quiet, locked in a staring contest. Their pupils explode with emotion, a fireworks display of alien feeling. Kez turns away abruptly, letting loose a guttural warble as he throws his arms up in exasperation. What's eating him? I ask.
War approaches cautiously, casting a glance at his companion.
Kez hunches over the console, radiating disagreement.
Kez, he worries for your mind, War explains softly. Your tale of hope, your dying sister, it affected him deeply. He fears that showing you the rest of the runaway story might shatter your consciousness beyond repair. There will be no perfect clone. Your sister will find no solace in her dying moments.
I watch Kez fiddle with the console, frustration evident in every movement. A wave of empathy washes over me. Maybe I've judged him too harshly. After all, he was just looking out for my sister.
Then again, he still wants to turn me into DNA soup.
This feels important, I say to War, clenching my fists. If the fate of humanity, of everything, is really at stake, then I think Hope would want me to help however I can. I force a smile, trying to hype myself up with false confidence. Besides, I can't imagine it's that bad.
You are right, War tells me, his hands resting on my temples. It is much worse than you could ever imagine.
You've been listening to His Crooked Gospel, Part 1, by J.G. Martin. J.G. Martin writes about monsters and the things they get up to when we aren't looking. His work has been featured across a slew of podcasts, captivating millions of listeners around the globe. Martin currently resides in British Columbia with his cat and editor, Opie. His ultimate dream is to one day own a secret lair behind a bookshelf.
Well, there's a cliffhanger. What a damn good line to end the episode with. In fact, I am now officially changing the tagline for Horror Hill to "It's much worse than you could ever imagine." But what's much better than you could ever imagine is the conclusion of this epic space opera. Next week, all secrets will be revealed, and you'll find out the ultimate fate of Isaiah Mitchell, his neurotic boss, the Vitarians, and even you, dear listeners. I can't bait the hook more than that. I hope to see you then, and until that time, stay spooky.
You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com, and we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.